This is an ABC podcast.
If you believe that Buddhists are all peace, love, and tranquility, just ask the Muslims in Myanmar for their perspective. Their reality doesn't match the image. Hi, I'm Amanda Vanstone. This is Counterpoint. The sign on a bakery that says homemade doesn't tell the truth. Their goods aren't made at home. In the same way, maybe the European Union isn't really united. But do things have to be perfect? As it turns out, some introduced species of both plants and animals can be very beneficial to the environment. And no, cane toads are not a good example. And with Christmas around the corner, we'll look at the power play that surrounds gift-giving. But first, the union that isn't united. We've heard a lot about the war in Ukraine, but one of the things we might not have looked at is the fact that it's been a test, a real test, of the European Union's ability to really act together. Not sure they've done that well with that, really. Anyway, to find out from someone who does know, we're going to talk to Ralph Schollhammer. He's an assistant professor in economics and political science at Webster University in Vienna. And he joins us now. Ralph Schollhammer, welcome to Counterpoint. And look, can we start a more serious discussion with a pretty simple question, but I think it does reveal something about the folly of the EU. What were they thinking when they set up this union to be a player in world affairs and then gave the bureaucrats to dictate what you could put in a sausage in a country if you were from the union?
Well, I guess that was a little bit both a feature and a bug of the European project, which was this idea that the world of the future, for which the European Union liked to see itself as a role model, would be obsessed, if you want, or focused on exactly these kind of things, right? On the minute details of life, because all the big questions have been answered. I mean, if we think back, and I know this is quoted way too often and mentioned way too often, so I promise it's the last time. I hope you can forgive me. But the European Union was a little bit the idea of the embodiment of Francis Fukuyama's end of history, right? The community of states that has overcome nationalism, that has overcome ideology, and is, as you just mentioned, is focused on, you know, the percentage of fat or trans fat in their sausages, because all the other problems have been solved. And for a long time, I mean, we can discuss whether we think that this was ever a valid idea, but this really has been the plan. So many of the things, which I do too, that we raise our eyebrows at, that are very easy to mock, that actually was part of the whole idea to say, well, we have solved all the great problems. The big questions of politics, of ideology have been answered. So it's only the small, minute details of life that are left to regulate and to organize.
Right. Now, what you've taught me there is that I can still mock the idea that the union could tell the bombs what they could put in their sausage, because you know what the English are like about their pork sausage. But their stupidity was not so much in telling them what to do with their sausage, but imagining that that was an important issue and imagining that the big issues have been solved. That was really their stupidity.
There is a form of stupidity that only very intelligent people are capable of. And I know that this is a big discussion in Australia as well, right? We see this in the energy sector. We see it in geopolitics, right? Maybe we wouldn't call them intelligent, but highly credentialed people, right? You know, university degrees and postgraduate degrees and, you know, internships with governments and all these kind of things hold ideas that seem to be very much detached from reality. And that's what I always figure. I know this is, again, an overused phrase, but this is very often, I find, kind of the late stage of a civilization, right? When kind of the basic facts of life have to make way for the eccentric ideas of a highly credentialed elite. And I think this is what we see in many areas. We saw it in Europe's energy policy. We see it in Europe's general geopolitics. But you also see traces of this in the United States, right? You see traces of this in Australia, if I might say so respectfully. I think this is something that ails the entire Western world. We have not yet been capable, despite also the war in Ukraine, to kind of rearrange or kind of realign reality and our ideological or at least our leaders' ideological preferences. And at some point, we're going to pay dearly for this. And I think this is slowly but certainly now materializing.
Well, let's talk about the EU. If you think of those countries, I know Italy likes you to think of them first because they were in the first three, but really it's a difference of opinion between Germany and France that often takes the sort of limelight, doesn't it? They don't always agree.
True. I mean, there was at least a tentative agreement between, like, that Paris and Berlin have to work in tandem during crisis, but it has become ever more clear over the last couple of years, and I'm sure that you heard this in Australia as well, right? The idea was that Europe or the European unification project is a peace project, particularly, of course, France and Germany, because the animosities between those two countries were very often seen as a key factor both in World War I and World War II. But I think what has become clear now, it's not just that Europe or European unification was a project for peace, it was a project that actually needs peace. And if we look back a little bit in history, this has been the case very early on. I mean, we tend to forget, but we had wars in Europe in the 1990s in the Balkans, right, when Yugoslavia was breaking up. Ukraine is, of course, much more significant because it involves Russia. But there was an almost unspoken deal between the Americans and the Europeans that the Europeans focused kind of on their internal issues. So they tried to prevent any risk of an inner European war from breaking out. But at the same time, the United States would provide global security for Europe. So what I mean by this, that the Americans basically built a kind of dam against waves of geopolitical turmoil crushing over Europe. And they could do so for a long time. But now that we see that there are more crises globally accumulating, right? We not just have the situation in Ukraine, as I'm sure you in Australia follow very closely. Something seems to be going on in China. We'll see what's going to happen there. But definitely people in Taiwan are more nervous than they have been a couple of years ago. And it becomes clear that maybe the United States will no longer be capable of shielding Europe from the rest of the world. And what this leads to is that European nations look at the world and say, so wait a moment, we probably have to do our own policy, right? We have to look at this world and come up with our own strategy. And if you have 27 members, since the United Kingdom has left recently, if you have 27 members in a union and they all look at the world differently, and they look at the world differently if you compare, let's say, Berlin and Paris, you compare it to, let's say, Warsaw or Budapest, Hungary, right? They look at the world differently. So as they now start to reformulate their own international, domestic and foreign policy, this is huge pressure on the cohesion and the ability of working together within the European Union. Yep. And I think this is only going to get worse.
Okay. Now, let's take that in two parts. First of all, the difference between France and Germany, original members, and then let's talk about the consequence of taking in other places and the different attitudes that they have in more central European states who've, as you know, pledged pretty much support for Kyiv. Now, when this was first happening, as I understand it from what you've said, Emmanuel Macron was sort of on the phone to Putin, seeing what he could organise. I don't know if that was behind everybody's back and he wanted to be the hero or whether they agreed, but that's his path anyway, to try and talk with Putin and get some sort of peace thing. And the French have been very supportive of Ukraine. But if you're to be believed, and I have no reason to suggest that you're not, that Berlin's initial proposal for supporting Ukraine was 5,000 helmets but no weapons. I mean, is that... that can't be right, can it? It's ridiculous.
No, that's true. I mean, the Berlin didn't even deny it. No, this is absolutely true. So I'm glad you mentioned this. It reflects something that I think was another one of these non-outspoken deals. If we, and I hope you can forgive me kind of if we always jump back so far in history, but if you think of the early 90s, right, of the first war in Iraq, right, and, you know, when after Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, and you look at how European nations behaved, like, the German approach was always, we're going to sign a check, but we never get actually involved. This was also for historical reasons, you know, kind of the memory of World War II. And so there was this almost implicit deal between Paris and Berlin that Paris would act as kind of the geopolitical, the external face of Europe, while Germany would sign the checks. but kind of, you know, not be in the international limelight. And this worked quite nicely because both sides agreed on it. The French, as you correctly also described with Emmanuel Macron, they wanted to kind of use the power of the Union to continue to represent themselves as a geopolitical force. And the Germans wanted to use the European Union to be economically powerful, but kind of somebody who's quietly in the background. Now, that idea or that agreement no longer worked in the case of Russia and Ukraine because of the very tight economic, particularly regarding natural gas, the tight economic connections between Russia and Germany. So Germany had, and I only mean this geopolitically, not morally, but Germany had an interest for this conflict to end as soon as possible, independently whether it would mean successful Ukrainian defense or a successful Russian invasion. The assessment in Berlin was, since you mentioned the helmet, was let's keep support, particularly weapons, very low, or kind of let's try to drag it out as long as we can, because if there would be a swift defeat of the Ukrainian forces, we can go back to the status quo before the war with just a somewhat, you know, geographically enlarged Russia. So this was the first time in a very long time that Germany actually, in its own way, acted geopolitically against the interests of what the French wanted to do. Because the French, due to their currently a little bit underused and for different reasons, for technological reasons, but due to the nuclear power that the French possess, right, for them, Russian gas was never that important. So they took a different stance from the beginning.
One of Merkel's big mistakes.
Exactly. So
I was a big fan of hers, but that was a big mistake.
Oh, yeah. This is it's an interesting conflict because it shows that the idea that there is no longer something like a national interest within the European Union is simply not true. It turns out that, and that's painful. I mean, I live in Europe, I'm here in Austria, in Vienna, so this is all fantastic. But it has become ever more clear that maybe the European Union wasn't really this supranational institution where countries gave up a lot of sovereignty and they all kind of unified in one common global outlook, but that countries used it for their own national interest as long as it served it perfectly. And now for the first time, we see differing or even conflicting national interests within the Union. And for me, at least, it looks like that at the end of the day, it's the national interest will supersede the European interest.
In other words, as you say in your article you've written for Spiked Online, you know, the Holy Roman Empire went on past its peak and the EU will as well, but we're at a point now where the big decisions are going to be made by individual European nation states. So this experiment is over. Ralf Schollhammer, even though it might not be over today, it is going to be over eventually, and we are very grateful you joined us today. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
All is not united in the Union, nor is it in Myanmar. In terms of the world's religions, many of us think that Buddhism is a very peaceful one. You know, they're not into killing, and that makes them nice people. But is that really the case? Is that what happens? I'm not sure, but I'll tell you who knows more about it than me, and that's Martin Kovan. He's a writer and ethicist, and he's the author of A Buddhist Theory of Killing, a philosophical exposition. And he joins us now from Sydney. Martin Kovan, what made you think I'm going to have a look at why Buddhists kill or what they think about killing?
Well, Amanda, it's a pretty big story for me. I was actually in Myanmar about a decade ago, at the beginning of the persecution of Rohingya Muslims by Burmese Buddhists. Naturally, as a Buddhist practitioner myself, I kind of was very curious about what is the status of killing for Buddhists on some fundamental level, as opposed to a more popular historical level of understanding. And so I was doing philosophy as part of my personal interest, and I thought to pursue it at the academic level and discovered that, in fact, there's vast discrepancies between what Buddhists themselves, empirical, historical, you know, people on the ground do and say and profess, and what Buddhist philosophy would give us to understand as the basic justification for these norms and values that it treasures.
Yes, I remember seeing, I mean, I can't describe it to you, I don't remember the detail of it, but I remember seeing a photo and press coverage of Buddhist monks arguing and fighting with Rohingya, like viciously.
Yeah.
And it was startling because it's not an image that you expect to see. You expect Buddhists to exude tranquility and calm, but that doesn't appear to be the case. So what did you find? I mean, let's go to the obvious question, and that is, what's the justification? How do so many Buddhists think it's okay to do what they're doing to Rohingya?
Well, this is kind of the nub of the problem, because you've said it there yourself. What do Buddhists think? The question is, are they functioning as Buddhists at that point? I mean, you know, each case is quite different. And I think in the Burmese case, it's not necessarily Buddhists who are trying to justify killing Rohingya Muslims or anybody else. It's the military powers of the country and its affiliate, you know, resources in policing and security and so on, who are deciding to kill people. And the question is, at that point, are these people still legitimately Buddhists, right?
But the photo I saw that was with the article,
yeah,
and it was probably all over the world. I mean, it was splashed
were
everywhere,
monks,
this
right?
thing.
Yeah.
Were monks, yeah. So, I mean, they're not meant to be Buddhists
so
in name
I'm
only, are they?
I'm not about to deny that there was Buddhist monks apparently involved in some violent, if not lethal, actions in central Burma. But, you know, it's an interesting question too. Empirically speaking, it's probably very few actual Sangha or monastics who are involved in those cases, which once put on a headline and splashed across Time magazine and so on and so forth looks extraordinarily serious, but it's actually hyperbolic because there's probably very few people
yes.
literally involved. There actually is a movement of Buddhist nationalism in Burma called the Mabata, which does promulgate anti-Muslim sentiment and certainly hate speech, but probably not violent, you know, retaliation or retribution of Muslim people. So it's a very varied situation. And the vast majority of Burmese Buddhists are certainly not out there lynching Muslims at every corner. So it's a very varied case. And as you go through history, you have to realize that there's 2,600 years of Buddhist history where Buddhism has been weaponized by various political and nationalist agendas to inculcate people to violence which they otherwise normally wouldn't have been willing to commit. And so you saw that during the 30-year tragic civil war in Sri Lanka. You've seen it in various Chinese contexts. You've also seen it in intersectarian violence between Buddhist groups, for example, in Tibet historically. You've seen it in Japan. Very famously, Japanese Zen teachers were mobilizing lay people to join the fascist war effort against the Allies as an expression of true Buddhist piety. Okay, so, you know, it's not as if empirically Buddhists won't end up weaponizing their own religious tenets in a way that ultimately undermines their own religious integrity. So it's incredibly conflicted, but also deeply unfortunate situation, because it also gives the so-called non-Buddhist world the sense that, you know, Buddhism does rationalize its own lethal violence in a way that, in fact, Buddhism simply doesn't. It's not within the remit of the religion. If you study the texts, if you look at the actual philosophical justifications, as I've done in my thesis, for why these norms and these values are deeply held, there actually is no remit for a Buddhist legitimized, rationalized form of justified violence.
Okay, now let's go to one of the great, I suppose it's the moral dilemmas people face.
Yeah.
Which is the lesser of two evils. And the Dalai Lama apparently in 2011 came close, if not emphatically, endorsed the dispatching of Osama bin Laden.
Indeed.
So how do Buddhists, not the nominal Buddhists, the real Buddhists, handle those choices? So someone is coming, a deranged person maybe, or a non-Buddhist, and they're clearly out to kill your family. Is it okay then as a Buddhist to kill them instead?
Well, obviously this is where the rubber hits the road of actual Buddhist practice. This is actually the topic of the last chapter of my book, where, you know, obviously one can hold and profess an intention not to commit lethal violence. But as you say, on occasions where one's family is imminently about to be slaughtered, what does one do? So, yeah, I mean, in these existential cases of immediate real-time threat, people will take decisions into their own hands according to their own lights. And, you know, the Dalai Lama in that particular instance, although he certainly wasn't threatened by Osama bin Laden, he understood, presumably, that, you know, Al-Qaeda at that time was a legitimate threat against world security, and so his words actually to the American administration at the time was, it is understandable that you would need to do that. So he wasn't actually endorsing that people should go out and actively try to kill people. It's a form of tolerance. I mean, the Buddha himself in the early texts is actually called upon by the ruling leader of his kingdom at the time to intervene in a potential military conflict with neighbors over water irrigation, of all things. And the Buddha says, look, you know, I don't advise going into immediate battle here. Is it possible that you can compromise? And he actually does act as an intermediary between these two groups who end up coming to some kind of agreement. So who knows? Maybe another Buddhist might say, look, maybe it's possible for us to do something here other than simply attack each other.
Sure.
And now, actually, if you look at the history of Buddhism compared to the history of other religions throughout the world, that has often, in fact, been the case. There have been no Buddhist wars of conquest.
Let's look at the aspects that Buddhists might take into account.
Yeah.
And that is, they might look at the intentions of the person who's going to do a bad thing, the particular action they're going to take, and the consequences that come from that. Now, is that the context in which, if you like, a framework under which you might decide whether you commit some act of violence?
Well, Amanda, you've actually just literally described the generalized received notion that you get in the later Buddhist school of the Mahayana, which is the school which is dominant in East Asia and in Tibet and China and Vietnam, where in fact you do have these high-level practitioners. They're called bodhisattvas, which kind of means an exemplary figure of the Buddha Dhamma. And indeed, those figures have precisely the kinds of cognitive and compassionate abilities which allow them to understand what a potential malefactor is about to do, okay? And, you know, for my money as a secular philosopher, this is a little bit presumptuous, because how does one rely on clairvoyant powers of knowing what someone is about to do? I mean, we can't necessarily know what someone else's intentions really are, right? And if we can tell that they're already lethal, then clearly, as you were saying just before, we have to do something about that. So I don't know whether we can predicate normative ethics on, you know, clairvoyant powers of precognition and so forth.
Yeah. Yeah. You raised notions around going to war and what that means, and I find them very clear and consequently quite uncomfortable, because you point out that we have to accept that when we go to war, living persons, you know, beings that we know, are determinedly exploited to serve an end beyond being killed. As you say, we don't go to war in order to pile up bodies.
Right.
We go to war to achieve some other end.
Yeah.
And someone has to decide, I suppose, if that end's appropriate. And what you're saying is that there haven't been Buddhist wars.
Well, there certainly haven't been Buddhist wars against non-Buddhists.
Except against the Rohingya, maybe.
There's been internecine conflict within Buddhist cultures and within the internal other to those cultures. So in that case, the Rohingya Muslim. Yes, that's true. But there certainly haven't been Buddhist wars of religious conquest like the Christian Crusade.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, the point you raise about war is absolutely, for my money, the ethical question of our time, because we don't see any deep proliferation of lethal warfare happening. We're very aware of what's happening in Ukraine as we speak. And I think this is a basically, theoretically, very underdetermined issue. And I know that sounds a little bit fancy.
I understand what you're saying. I get that. I mean, in the case of Russia and Ukraine, you can say, well, you know, there shouldn't be a war. So the answer to that is, or the consequence of making that decision is, you just let the people who want to invade, invade. Because if you're in a world where someone chooses to initiate violence, you're then put in the position about whether you, you know, respond or not. That's the problem. People have tried other ways, and as I understand it, according to the media, are trying other ways, you know.
Well,
shutting Russian bank accounts, Russian oligarchs, yachts that they've nicked money to buy, the kleptocrats, etc., but it's not having a sufficient impact. So I'm all into nature, but I bought some bird boxes, bird nesting boxes.
Right.
And the other day, some rainbow lorikeets came and kicked out the Rosella parrots. And then a few days later, there's a dogfight in the air. Like if you made them planes and filmed it, it would be Star Wars sort of thing, between two pairs of lorikeets. Now, nature does this, and we are a part of nature, so why don't we accept that?
Well, obviously,
nature is vicious.
Obviously, we do accept it, but we're also prey and privy to evolutionary processes, which we are also happy to accept. On other levels, we're now able to take into control a lot of our own procreative possibilities, among other things. And yet, it's very interesting that in this one particular conditioned evolutionary behavior, namely, you know, the killing of human groups with each other, we actually haven't progressed apparently beyond, you know, Neanderthal times. I mean, I really wouldn't know. I'm not an evolutionary biologist. But, you know, it's quite extraordinary that with the vast amounts of resources and consideration and scientific attention that is paid to technological advance, so rapid that we can't literally control it.
Yes.
The one thing which we can begin to control, which, for example, the Buddha in his wisdom tried to inculcate in people 2,600 years ago, is also the one thing in which we have made no progress. And this is really quite extraordinary. And I actually personally think that we're at a point now where we have to start reframing what lethal warfare, for example, actually is. I don't think it's enough to legitimate it or normalize it by virtue of geopolitical discourse, for example. I think we should start clinicizing it. I think warfare is actually subclinical. I think it's a form of collective psychopathology, where people know that if they're about to get into a situation where potentially tens of thousands of basically innocent, peace-loving people are about to lose their lives.
Not basically, absolutely.
Sure, they have done. Surely in any other context, we would call that a form of mental illness, right?
Well, we don't.
But we legitimize it. Right?
Yeah, you know, I made the reference back to nature being vicious, and it is. Yeah. It's brutal, you know, when you see the penguins being snatched off.
Species-centric, lorikeets and other creatures lack reason, and we don't. We have the opportunity to get somewhere with our own forms of reason and understanding.
Well, we might, you know, but when the seals jump up and snatch the baby penguins off the rocks, they reason that if they hang around near the rocks, they'll get them. It's all very ugly. I mean, I just wonder whether in the end we need to accept who we are and manage it better rather than try and not be the animals that we are.
Yeah. Well, I would call that a pragmatic response. That sounds like a good, solid Australian pragmatic response, and I would support it. But my fear is...
You think there's a higher response that we could have?
Well, not just that, but there's also the added existential threat that if we don't start working it out relatively quickly, then I don't know whether at the rate we're going we'll actually be able to survive.
Oh, we'll survive. I'm an optimist. I mean, look at the world's history. We've survived, and we will continue to survive.
Well, true, but I'm a bit of an acolyte of Noam Chomsky, who is repeatedly drawing attention to the doomsday clock, which puts us at closer we've ever been to nuclear annihilation in human history than now. We are as close as we've ever been to potential annihilation, according to Noam Chomsky, and I don't think he has spurious reasons for holding that view. It really just takes a small crisis and we don't know what could happen.
Yeah. Martin Coman, it's been a fascinating discussion, not a happy one. I mean, happy between us, but it's not a happy subject. And perhaps that's why people don't pay sufficient attention to it, because we did think it was the end of wars in Europe, and now the stark reality of that has smacked us in the face. And perhaps we therefore need to start thinking again about this, and looking at the Buddhist perspectives of it is a helpful way to do it. Martin Coman, thanks for joining us today on Counterpoint.
Thank you, Amanda. I appreciate it.
Here's the rant. Recently, I looked at a tweet site of someone who'd been critical of an opinion with which I have some but not complete sympathy. The person was proudly Labour, and I found myself agreeing with a subsequent and unrelated tweet. She basically said, if you want to whinge about politics, get off your backside and get involved. Now, she's saying, in her case, with the Labour Party, but she goes on to point out, it doesn't matter, just get involved. She is so right. If we all sit back, the extremists will be in charge of everything. Now, we live in a country where you can say pretty much what you want. Value that. Be a part of keeping it. As this woman says, get involved somewhere. Christmas is around the corner and there'll be some gift giving. My advice, just say thank you and shut up. Make out like you like it. But there's politics in gift giving. It's important to know about it. With Christmas around the corner, gift giving is on the agenda and receiving. And it's sometimes a difficult issue. What do you give?
you know, you have to find something the person likes. A gift is not just a gift so that you've been seen to do something. You really want it to actually be welcomed by the person. But gift giving can be a bit complex, you know. It's not as simple as you think. Oh, no. Joining us to discuss this will be Gilly Klieger. She's a postdoctoral college fellow at Harvard University, and she teaches history and social theory. And she's written a great article called Keeping the Score. Subtitle, The Gifts We Exchange Are Both Generous and Yet Fraught with Social Rules and Obligations. Do you think Marcel Mauss's essay would be a good thing if more than academics read it?
I definitely think that. I mean, I teach and I assign it whenever I can because I think students always enjoy reading it. And it's often not on a syllabus in just a general social theory class. But in general, I think it has lessons to offer everyone, you know, students and people beyond the university.
Well, when I was studying it, which was a fair while ago, I recall reading all about the, you know, the gift giving of shells in the islands, and the big chief could give the bigger shells, and you were therefore felt indebted, and a gift was more a display of wealth. It's never left me, you know, because you see that in gift giving with some people. It's more about a demonstration of them, maybe their wealth, maybe their cleverness in finding the gift or whatever. But you, to your great credit, have used a Seinfeld example to explain this to people. Tell us about this story, because it does explain Marcel Mauss's theory, but in, you know, language we all understand.
Yeah, sure. So there are actually plenty of examples in Seinfeld where a gift gone awry or the obligation to have to reciprocate a gift becomes the starting point for the entire episode. So I started by talking about an example where George complains that he has to bring something to a dinner, that he can't show up empty-handed. And why that's the right place to start thinking about the gift is that that's really the question that Marcel Mauss begins with, which is, why do we feel compelled to reciprocate gifts? Why do we feel that we can't show up to a dinner empty-handed? Why do we feel that if someone gives us something, we have to in some way find a way to reciprocate? And the reason that question is interesting is that we tend to think about gifts in a very different way than we think about just normal economic exchanges. Gifts we think of as being something we do just out of kindness, or we do them voluntarily, and we don't give a gift because we expect necessarily receive something in return. And yet, we all know that we have all of these rules that suggest that when you receive a gift, you have to reciprocate. So in that sense, actually, gift giving starts to look not that different from what goes on when we engage in economic exchanges.
Sure. I mean, someone recently very kindly, because I gave them a recipe for beetroot pickling, gave me some fresh broad beans. But because it was a bit later that she gave me the beans, I felt I had to reciprocate. So I took the beans from inside her gate and left a jar of marmalade. That's just sort of what you do. These rules about gift giving go down to the simple community level. But what about re-gifting? Now, I ask that because in the summer holidays, a lot of people go to the beach and have each other to dinner and all that, or lunch or whatever, and they'll come with something. And you can end up at the end of the summer with a lot of somethings. So a lot of those somethings end up being re-gifted. What's the story with re-gifting from Seinfeld?
Yeah, so there's a memorable Seinfeld episode where at one point Elaine receives dental work from Bryan Cranston's character for free. And so then she feels compelled to reciprocate that free dental work by giving him a label maker. And then, of course, months later, Jerry gives the same dentist character a set of Super Bowl tickets. And to reciprocate, the dentist re-gifts him the label maker that he received from Elaine.
Oh, dear.
And then, of course, Elaine realizes when she sees that Jerry has this label maker that this same label maker has been making the rounds, right? And clearly it showed that he didn't quite appreciate a label maker all that much.
Yeah. Is it a bad thing to re-gift? I mean, is a gift meant to be something that the person takes to heart and clutches forever as a gift from, you know, Mary and I must treasure this? Or is it more a statement of what you want to give? Do you have any ideas about where a gift fits?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's something nice about the idea of regifting, in that it's a way that an entire community is in some ways linked through the passage of a single item. I mean, that's what makes the story in Seinfeld kind of funny. You know, suddenly there's this relationship that exists by virtue of this object between first Elaine and the dentist, and then between the dentist and Jerry Seinfeld. And then that, of course, links him back to Elaine. And so to see this single object passing through all these people is a kind of concrete way that we can think about the community as being bound together.
Yeah. Now, what about de-gifting?
Yeah, I mean, we have Seinfeld to thank both for coining the word re-gifting and de-gifting when, in that episode, Jerry actually wants the Super Bowl tickets back because he realizes that he can go to the Super Bowl. And so George says, well, if he can re-gift, why can't you de-gift? But of course, we know that you can't really ask for a gift back once you've already given it. So re-gifting seems to be okay, but de-gifting seems to transgress our social norms.
That's one of the things that I loved about studying sort of anthropology, sociology, and that is how our social rules, which we all obey, can be and are actually a lot more effective than a lot of the legal rules that we pass in parliaments. And de-gifting is one very bad thing. The other is if you just try and with every person you see for the remainder of the day, stand within like 1 foot, 12 inches, 30 centimetres of them in front of their face. It won't work well. We have an unwritten but understood clear social rule that you do not, quote unquote, get in someone's face. And that is stronger than, you know, traffic laws that can kill people. So the study of these things is important, isn't it? I know some people say, well, the social sciences, it's really the hard sciences that are going to deliver us from this perilous situation we're in. But the social sciences are important because otherwise we wouldn't understand these things, would we?
Yeah, and I totally agree that what makes social rules different than, say, legal rules is that they are unwritten and unspoken, and yet we all come to learn them somehow. And so what, you know, the study of anthropology and social theory does is it gives us a language for talking about these rules, or we have Seinfeld to point them out sometimes as well. But I agree that what is interesting about them is these are rules that go unwritten. They're kind of just in the air, they're in the water, but we need to have a language in which to talk about them in order to understand why something like gift giving is so important and so much part of the fabric of social life.
Yeah. When I was in Parliament, there was a group who used to meet, I think it was Thursday nights, and have dinner after Parliament had finished. And one of them had been economically luckier than the others. So in a dinner near the end of the term, around Christmas time, around now, he rolls up to the dinner with five other guys and says, oh, by the way, Happy Christmas, and gives each of them an Hermes tie. Now, these guys wouldn't spend that much money on their wife's present. They've got their kids' schooling to pay for. They've got their kids' presents to buy, you know, the holidays, blah, blah, blah. And this person just comes up and exhibits great generosity. Now, I'm sure it wasn't intended. I know the person involved. It wasn't intended to be a here I am a rich guy. I can afford to do this. But a gift can be a put down, can't it? A way of saying I can give this and you can't.
Yeah, definitely. And that's what was interesting to most about gifts is that they're not just these acts that we do out of kindness and generosity. They're so much bound up with power, and they can be acts that are in some ways hostile, right? Or it's a way of asserting, in this example that you gave, it could also be a way of asserting the power someone has over another or the wealth someone has over another. And especially if they give a gift that simply is so great it can't possibly be repaid, then he's now established his superiority, right, over the others. And so that is what's so interesting about gifts, is that they are bound up both with ideas of friendship and hostility, power and generosity. And it's very hard to kind of distinguish all of these things.
Yes, I think that we should talk about this no more, Gilly, because that point is a great point to end on, and that is that the gift can be all these negative things, a show of power, a display of wealth, a desire to make someone feel indebted. That certainly happens. But it can be, in its purest form, what kids imagine it to be. Giving someone something that you think they'd really appreciate, and the pleasure in them appreciating it, is the gift that comes back to you. Gilly Cleeger, thanks very much for joining us on Counterpoint today.
Thank you for having me.
We certainly don't look at the cane toad as a gift, quite the opposite. But introduced species can in fact be a gift. Maybe you know someone whose forebears came out here on assisted passage for a whole variety of reasons we did that. For example, a lot of migrants from Ireland came out in that way. If they were agricultural workers, they got a bit of assistance to come. So assisted migration is a well understood concept in migration countries or immigration countries such as we are. But what about assisted migration for native species? I mean, we do it. Why shouldn't they? Zach St. George is a freelance writer in Baltimore. We've spoken to him before because he wrote a great book, The Journey of Trees, and we spoke mostly about spruce trees. But now we're going to talk to him about assisted migration for native species. Zach St. George, how long has the concept of assisted migration for native species been around? You know, in a real way rather than just talked about loosely.
Sure. So assisted migration, it's important to clarify what it is, I think. And what we're really talking about is moving species to places where they don't currently occur and moving them as a conservation method. So this is different from the types of kind of routine translocations we do for yes. agriculture and horticulture and just for fun. We carry our favorite species around the world for all sorts of reasons. But back in the 1980s, people started to think about the consequences of climate change and look around and say, you know, humans have really altered the surface of the earth in a huge way, and it's going to make it a lot harder for some species to get to places where the climate will be suitable to them. So this has really been an idea that we've been talking about for more than 30 years now.
Right. Now, your article starts with a discussion about the cocoa, which is not a brand of chocolate, but rather the Guam Rail. Tell us about the Guam Rail.
Yeah, so the Guam Rail, it is a cute little bird. So it's a brown bird with, I think, about chicken striped. I have to confess, I've never actually seen one in person about chicken sized. But it is native to Guam, an island in the Pacific, that in the 20th century, people introduced green tree snakes. And these snakes are very good at catching these rails, which do not have the ability to fly. They're flightless birds.
So, do we know why they introduced the snakes?
I believe it was accidental. I'm not certain of that. Yeah, I think it was an accidental introduction. Yep. I think these snakes like to climb. They were probably on the rigging of some ship or something like that. So one way or the other, these snakes got to this island and they found basically an ecosystem where there were no predators of that type. There was the Guam rail, there was Guam kingfishers. There's a number of species that basically had no real defenses against this snake.
So now some of these birds are going to an island, Rota, about 40 miles away. How long before we know whether it's worked?
Right. So back in the, I want to say in the 80s, these Guam rails were listed as endangered under the Endangered Species Act by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which administers the act. And typically, when you list an endangered species under the Endangered Species Act here in the United States, you have to designate critical habitat and basically say, this is the habitat that this species needs to survive. If this species is to recover, it needs this habitat. This is really crucial for the species' survival. For the Guam rail, that just really wasn't possible because there was nowhere on Earth where the rail occurred naturally, and there were no tree snakes. And at that time, there was really no prospect of getting rid of the tree snakes. So Fish and Wildlife took the unusual step back in the 1980s or maybe the early 90s of gathering up what Guam rails it could find in the wild, starting a captive breeding program, and then moving them to this island of Rota, which is about 40 miles over water from Guam. So outside of the species' known current or historical range.
And has it worked?
Has it worked? I think as of the five-year assessments that Fish and Wildlife does for species under the Endangered Species Act, the species has not recovered. I think its numbers are steady, maybe growing on Rota. So it hasn't worked in the sense of leaving the species in a place where it can sort of just manage on its own. What it has done is kept this species alive because prospects were really bad. And to maintain a species in a captive breeding program in a zoo or a series of zoos forever is difficult. It's expensive.
And heartbreaking, frankly. I mean, why do we do it?
Of course.
I'm not against zoos for a whole variety of reasons, but to say you've saved a species because you've got it locked up is a bit sad. And I think the plan is to get rid of these snakes. Eventually they'll get rid of the snakes and then they'll be able to take some of these rails back. Is that right?
Right. I think that is the hope. So, yeah, I mean, like you say, zoos are kind of a sad version of salvation. And so whether or not the rails on Rota are a recovered species, you know, it's better than extinction, certainly.
There's lots of arguments about this, aren't there? Because I think some wolves, for example, were reintroduced into the Yellowstone Park area, and some people are touchy about that because they're frightened of wolves. But we've had other interviews where the reintroduction of a species, not necessarily what we're talking about, that is assisted migration to an area they otherwise weren't in, but the reintroduction of species to areas they were in has actually had wonderful benefits for the environment. People seem to think of a lot of predator animals as being bad things we should get rid of and don't seem to get it, that they're a part of the ecosystem. What do we do with assisted migration? Bring another species in. There are some risks, but they've been generally well managed, haven't they?
Yes. So this idea of assisted migration, like I say, it's been around since the 1980s, and it's been quite controversial because, you know, I think a lot of the lessons of ecology and humans kind of meddling in ecology is that you shouldn't move species from one place to another. There's lots of examples of things going really badly. So the brown tree snake being introduced into Guam is a good example of a...
So is the Indian mongoose in the West Indies. And do I have to mention the cane toad to Australia?
Right, of course. That's another classic example. It's people moving things for what seem like good reasons and doing a poor job of predicting what's actually going to occur. And, you know, the rabbits in Australia is another classic story.
Yeah.
The list just goes on and on. So this idea of basically saying that we humans can presume to know where these species will do well and also not make things worse for the recipient ecosystem, a lot of people have not been on board with that for a long time.
Yeah. Now, what is it with Guam that people are focusing on it so much? Because there's a similar action taking place with another bird from Guam, that is the Guam kingfisher, which was extinct in the wild and now it's being introduced to an island nearby. So it makes me think, what was happening in Guam? Was it just this one snake?
Yeah, it seems to mostly be the snake in Guam. And, you know, islands over and over again, there's been this pattern of invasion in islands, of biological invasions, of new species arriving and really devastating the native species on islands. You know, there's various hypotheses about what kind of the evolutionary mechanisms at work there are, but basically the gist is that there's just fewer other species to deal with on an island for the most part. And so you bring in these continental species that kind of have a more maybe varied background and they just are able to basically exploit weaknesses or sort of vulnerabilities that these island species have. And so it's not just Guam. It's kind of a repeating story. You see it in Hawaii. What is unusual here is that currently Fish and Wildlife and how it administers the Endangered Species Act has really not allowed species to be moved outside of their native or, quote, historical range. And so that actually has really limited the examples of assisted migration, at least here in the United States.
Well, I think what we've sort of figured out with this is that it is possible to, if you like, translocate species. You do need to take account of the environment into which you're releasing them, both for their welfare and for the welfare of the current environment. You don't want something that you introduce to be devastating on other animals. But it can be done. There are occasional problems. I mean, you raised an example of one. It's not the best example of assisted migration. What was that?
Yeah, so there's a good example in Alabama of the watercress darters, which conservationists moved basically from one spring to another, thinking that this other spring where they did not naturally occur would be kind of a better place for them. What they didn't realize was that this other species of darter, this little tiny fish that was in the recipient spring, it turns out they had done their taxonomy wrong. It was not the species they thought it was. It was an entirely different species that basically occurred just in that spring and maybe a couple other ones. So the watercress darters that they put in there outcompeted these native darters and drove them to extinction in that particular set of springs. They do persist elsewhere, but it is a good example of, you know, this kind of well-planned and certainly well-intentioned action leading to these unintended consequences.
Zach St. George, it's been a pleasure talking to you today. I often wonder why people imagine that animals shouldn't be allowed to do the things that we do. I mean, we move around, we go to places where you have to say if there was a designer to the universe, we weren't intended to be. We move around at will. I don't see why animals shouldn't. We keep putting up fences to stop their natural migrations. And now some people are touchy because we want to assist them getting a chance at life. Honestly, some people, you just can't explain. Zach St. George, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's the program for this week. Thanks for joining, and I hope you join again next week. As you know, if you want to tell us something, go to the ABC site, go to RN and follow the prompts to Counterpoint. Obviously, we can't mention everyone who writes in, but don't think for one minute that we're not listening. Until next week, Amanda Vanstone saying see you later.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.